All right, 2 minute meditation starts now.
Hey guys, repeat after me. God,
God,
we invite you here tonight.
We invite you here tonight
to guide us and direct us.
Guide us and direct us.
Please set aside.
Please set aside
that within each of us.
That within each of us
that would block us from the truth.
That would block us from the truth.
Please set aside.
Please set aside
what we think we know.
What we think we know
about the big book.
About the big book.
12 steps.
12 steps.
Addiction.
Addiction.
Alcoholism.
Alcoholism.
Ourselves.
Ourselves.
And especially you, God.
Especially you, God.
Set aside what we think we know.
Set aside what we think we know.
About all these things.
About all these things.
So we can have an open mind.
So we can have an open mind.
An open heart.
An open heart.
And a new experience.
And a new experience.
Help us see the truth.
Help us see the truth.
Amen.
Amen.
All right, this reading is called Beginning. This is the moment of embarking. All auspicious signs are in place. In the beginning, all things are hopeful. We prepare ourselves to start anew. Though we may be intent on the magnificent journey ahead, all things are contained in this first moment. Our optimism, our faith, our resolution, our innocence. In order to start, we must make a decision. The decision is a commitment to daily self-cultivation. We must make a strong connection to our inner selves. Outside matters are superfluous. Alone and naked, we negotiate all of life's travails. Therefore, we alone must make something of ourselves, transforming ourselves into the instruments for experiencing the deepest spiritual essence of life. Once we make our decision, all things will come to us. Auspicious signs are not superstition, but a confirmation. They are a response. It is said that if one chooses to pray to a rock with enough devotion, even that rock will come alive. In the same way, once we choose to commit ourselves to spiritual practice, even the mountains and the valleys will reverberate to the sound of our purpose.
All right, gentlemen, round two. So the first session, our intent was to share our experience or tell parts of our stories while also illustrating the powerlessness in our relationship with drugs and alcohol. And powerlessness is just half a step one. But to understand how important powerlessness is, I always like to line it up to the big book. And how much time does our book spend? So if you count the doctor's opinion, which is 8 pages, and then all the way from page 1 to page 43, 43 plus 8, 51 pages to talk about one half of the first step. Once I start, I lose power, choice, and control over how much does my life and my experience with drugs and alcohol abundantly confirm that? Yes. Once I stop, I cannot stay stopped on my own power. Without some type of psychic change or personality change or spiritual awakening, my mind will always take me back to the desperate experiment of the first one, no matter how great and the necessity to stay away from the first one. My experience says bad shit happens, I forget. I have a forgetter. I don't have access to the past. So how do we protect ourselves from those certain times? What is it that brings the mind back to that place? Our big book calls it restlessness, irritability, discontent. I like three other words that I like to use. Feeling uneasy. Easily annoyed. And dissatisfied with my life. That internal condition is what we call the manifestation of the spiritual malady, which is conscious separation from ourselves, conscious separation from others, conscious separation from a God of our understanding. All that exists is our over-fixation with what's going on in this thing up here between my ears, which is called the mind. The breeding ground, that internal condition, is what the 12 steps are designed to treat. Because the internal unmanageability, as I called it, restless irritability and discontent, brings the mental phenomenon back. So I attempt the desperate experiment of the first one, and then the powerlessness takes place, and I can't control how much. And then I go off on this spree, and I emerge remorseful with that firm resolution that I'm not doing again. Remember, looking in the mirror, tear comes out of my eye. That firm resolution not to do it again, and then I come to a stopping point, but then I can't sit with myself because that guilt and that shame and that remorse combined with irritability, discontent, and just not being satisfied and having anxiety and feeling bored and lost, I can't exist in that place. And so I must have an effect. So sobriety for people like us is not the solution. Sobriety for people like us is the problem, because everyone sitting in this room is an individual that must have an effect produced by what we're doing in life. We cannot stand just being sober. So sobriety, not the answer, guys. You may not have heard it before, but I'm going to tell you tonight. So the 12-step process and this relationship with a power greater than ourselves is designed to treat that internal condition. And when the internal condition is treated, the mind will never take you back to the desperate experiment of the first one. You'll be placed in this phenomenal, fascinating place called the position of neutrality. The illusion that I ever had a choice is actually removed. And it happens automatically with very little thought or effort on our part. The thought and effort that we're about to put forth is about shrink Tarek, grow God. Shrink Tarek, grow God. That's what the whole thing is about. Growing along spiritual lines to shrink Tarek and grow God. That's what we do here. That's what treats the internal condition. The mind will not take you back. It's a layer by layer by layer. The physical is the top layer, easy to see. Once I start, I cannot stop. Below it is this mental phenomenon that I don't have a choice in a state of consciousness called sobriety. I don't have a choice. Like I explained with the example of leaving the garage and going to the red light. So the spiritual malady, which is this conscious separation from God, that is the breeding ground for the mental obsession or the mental component of our problem to come back. Because that was me in those 3 years of bouncing in and out, man. I went to IOP. I went to sober living. I went to a halfway house. I went to a residential treatment. And I was not surrendered. I didn't even have that component, but I wasn't willing to listen to anything. But the minute I got uncomfortable, the minute I got angry or judgmental towards someone, it was like the only answer I had was putting an anesthetic in my body to cope with it. That was my only solution. And I drift back to a long time ago when I was about 15 or 16 years old, and I discovered the power of alcohol, right? I had this friend whose parents let us drink at their house. And some of us had cars and some of us didn't, but his parents would collect all the car keys. And I remember this one particular weekend, there was a bunch of good-looking girls, a bunch of guys. We're all out by the pool. And you guys have, you know, picked up. I mean, I don't sound like I'm Tarek. I mean, Tarek sounds like he's from the Middle East or something, which I am. But, you know, I had this name, Tarek. I look like I'm Irish. So everyone always did a double take when I was growing up. They'd hear me talk, see my name on paper, and just didn't understand what was going on. And what that did, because of all the experiences, it really made me insecure. And really, I was full of anxiety on top of a broken home with the alcoholic, violent father and the mom that doesn't know what to do and all these circumstances, right? And I'm sitting at this pool party and I'm terrified. And to make things even more interesting, the guy had the deep end of the pool, and there was like 10 feet of concrete, maybe 8 feet of concrete, and then there was this shed, right? It was a shed that was flat, but it was where the lawnmower was and all his dad's tools and the workbench, right? And I am terrified of heights, and these guys are getting up on this shed, running across it, and jumping into the deep end of the pool. And of course, in my mind, I think all these girls are really impressed by that kind of shit, you know? That's what a 15, 16-year-old thinks. And I'm terrified, and I'm sitting there, and I'm drinking. And somewhere between the second and fifth drink, I had a vast change in feeling and outlook. Somewhere between the second and the fifth drink, I had a profound alteration in my reaction to that moment. Somewhere between the second and the fifth drink, God did for me what I could not do for myself. I had the courage to climb up on that shed, run across it, and jump into the deep end of the pool. And when I got out of that pool, I felt like I could just talk a little bit better. I felt like I looked a little bit better. And hell, it didn't only change me, it changed everybody at the pool party. I had a spiritual experience when I discovered the power of alcohol. That's some powerful shit. And that's why I began the courtship of alcohol, which later turned into cocaine and many other substances, because they did for me what I could not do for myself. For a long time, they worked. They were a weapon. Drugs, cocaine, whiskey, hookers, selling drugs, widespread panic. They were a weapon that I forged. They gave me identity. It gave me confidence. It made me participate in the world. And that weapon that I forged returned in its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. The very thing that woke my ass up was going to put my ass to sleep. And so I tried this, all these solutions, you know, all these countless vain attempts that I could drink like other people, that I could use. I had friends that could get high on the weekends. I swear to God. I had friends that could smoke crack Friday, Saturday, go to sleep all day Sunday, and go to work on Monday. And it's like they grew out of the phase. I never could understand it. I wasn't that guy. And I was smart. And I could not wrap my mind around why they could do it and I couldn't. So I was going to think my way through this problem. But what ends up happening is my relationship with drugs and alcohol beats me into a state of reasonableness. Another way, there's nothing better than a well-whooped ass when you get here. A well-whooped ass will fucking open up your ears quickly. This is a book called A New Pair of Glasses. It's by a guy named Chuck Chamberlain. I don't know if I'll ever meet an enlightened alcoholic or addict. But by reading this man's book, I'm willing to bet that's about as close as we're going to get. Right? Amazing book. Highly recommended. He says, "So I would say to you right off the bat that the greatest single event that has ever happened in my life, and I'm 72 years old, happened in January of 1946. This is from 1975. When the bottle beat me to death. Had it been necessary for me to consciously surrender the first time, I would have died without coming to this program. There was no way that I could surrender. I had never admitted defeat one time in 43 years of life. Not to God, not to another man, a woman, or the devil. The word surrender was not in my vocabulary. It had been bred out of me for generations. So thank God on my last trip out, the bottle, or the pipe, or the spike did it for me. The roadblock was burned out, and I got to the program in a state of total abandonment of self. And everything in the fifth chapter of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, was something I wanted to do. The first time I ever heard it. The very first night, when I heard chapter 5 read, everything in it was something I wanted to do. And I'm certain it was because of this total state of abandonment of self in which I got here." And when I read this the first time, man, I remember getting out of jail, going to the treatment center. They took me to that Friday night meeting. And the following Monday night, I was at this guy Dante's house in his big book workshop. And everything he talked about, I wanted to do. And I know this is a hard pill to swallow for you guys. Those six or seven guys he talked about that showed up to that 5 a.m. meditation, there was something in them that wanted to do it. And it wasn't of them. That's the cold, cold truth. That you nor me can work that part of the first step, which is the gift of desperation. Because I've seen plenty of people with a well-whipped ass that didn't have it. So for 3 years, I took a big book study through the Harbor Lights program at the Salvation Army in Atlanta. Now, this was a rough place, guys. I went down there every third month for 3 years. Me and my buddy Carl, typically, we would go down there and we would read this book with them and we would share our experience. I sponsored a lot of guys over those 3 years. So did Carl. And all the times we were down there carrying the message, two guys stayed sober. And they all had well-whooped asses. What was the difference? For some reason, the other two had commitment. They wanted to do the work. And that desire didn't come from within. It was a gift. The interesting things about, you guys ever get that gift that you're just so like grateful that you got? And the person who gave it to you is like, there's just something in you just wants to repay it. That's the way I feel with this gift I got from God. Because I've been doing this work long enough to know that it doesn't happen for everybody. I don't know if it's your time. I pray to God that it is. There is a way out, which Brandon and I will agree on with absolute harmony. It's in this book. It's not the only way out, though, but it's one that works 100% of the time. I have not, in 15 years, I have never seen anyone fail who has thoroughly followed the path. Here's the deal, though. Rarely have I seen anyone thoroughly follow the path. What's up with that? Why do so many people come, but so few stay? What's that about?
Yeah. Byron, so I always struggle with this, like the question of do we have a choice, right? Because I do believe, you know, grace is kind of granted, not earned, right? So like either we choose to surrender to our flesh or what people call ego, or we choose to surrender our choice to the spirit, but it's still a choice within that. Like, you know, we choose our attitude, we choose whether what we surrender. Like, you know, they say we have not because we ask not. So I believe the only thing we own is a choice, is to choose whether I want to surrender to my flesh or surrender to the spirit. So, you know, I have a hard time. I don't have a choice. I feel like we have a choice to say, God, will you help me? Because I know I'm powerless. Once I choose to do drinking or drugging, I give up my choice to that. Or I can choose to ask God to take what I'm powerless over. But that in itself is a choice, don't you think?
We're both going to answer that question. So he's going to go first.
So I usually close this session with this story, but I'll fire it off now because it's appropriate. So you're kind of looking at it from a philosophical standpoint, and I'm going to give you an answer that's completely not philosophical at all. Okay. So 3 years sober, done the work, sponsoring a ton of guys. Okay. I'm at my parents' place out at the lake, same patio that I slept with my dog on that night that I didn't die, right? I'm sitting there, I'm the grill master, right? I'm always responsible for cooking all the grill stuff, and I'm sitting there. It's the end of a perfect day, right? Wonderful day that the family's up in the house, they're laughing, they're carrying on. Temperature's that perfect, you know, evening temperature, maybe a nice cool breeze coming through. Thought comes, it would be nice to have a beer right now. Okay. My standard response in my head is always a kind of a chuckle of, yeah, but you're not capable of having a beer, right? Thought stays. Interesting. Why am I still thinking about having this beer? Then another thought comes and it says, you know, you could walk down the patio, go in the rec room, go in the beer fridge, grab a beer. Nobody would know. You could have that and maybe have a couple. Family probably, nobody there really cared if I was sober. I was just weird at that point because they were all hammered and I wasn't, right? So they probably would welcome me to go have a beer, right? Okay, so then the thought is, man, this thought's hanging around for a little while. I should probably call somebody. Okay. Monday night, that's the Saturday night. Monday night, I'm sitting down with the sponsee. I'm talking about a position of neutrality and this thing. And I'm talking about that experience. And the only reason why I remember this story is because that sponsee said, so what'd you do? So what do you mean? He goes, so what'd you do? I'm like, I don't understand your question. He goes, obviously you didn't drink because you're here sitting across from me right now. So what did you do? It's like, I don't know. And he goes, did you call somebody? No. He said, did you ask God to remove it? I don't think so. I don't know if a boat came roaring through the cove. I don't know if the grill flared up. I don't know if somebody came down from the house and distracted me. I don't have any clue what happened. But the thought was removed. That thought being removed of it would be nice to have a drink and I can go have a drink was not of me. I didn't create that. Okay? So yes, philosophically, I was living in this spiritual way on the spiritual path. And God kept me safe and protected only because I was willing to rely upon whatever this power is. But that choice was made way, way back there. The spiritual fitness showed up. The position of neutrality showed up later on. And that's the thing that I like to ask people when they're talking about how they don't have to make this amend. Or they don't have to meditate every day. Or they don't have to do their evening review. I ask them, okay, so what is the exact set of circumstances that's going to show up in your life when a drink or a drug looks like a good idea? And I mean, what do you mean? I'm like, what are all of the circumstances of your life going on in the moment where you decide that you're going to have a drink or a drug? And they can't answer the question. And then my question to ask them after that is, so which one of these steps do you not have to do in order for that not to show up? Because we don't know what part of the program is actually keeping us sober, keeping us in conscious contact, and keeping us in that position of neutrality. We can't figure out which part we can skimp on. Okay?
And I think that's, I understand what you're saying. I think kind of my,
so you're,
what I was talking about is just that choice of admitting we're powerless. That's the choice. You know, we're making the choice to open ourselves up to the steps and letting your spirit lead that, so you're not, you know, and after we make that choice to give it up to the spirit, then that spirit is leading.
Yeah.
I'm just talking about first step experience of giving my choice.
I get it. So an individual's conception of God influences the way you're going to look at this. Okay. So for me, when I have a character defect that says that if your experience, my experience is the experience, not true. Okay. But the double-edged sword here, my experience is all I got to go off of, but my experience is not the experience. Because that would limit the power of God. Okay? Second, if your experience is different from my experience, you must be lying about your experience. That's another defect I got. Right? And I'm putting this out there. So there's no gospel to what I'm about to say. You have to have your own experience. The way I get to this place is, I can't remember the last time I woke up and asked God to keep me sober and made that daily surrender. The thought never occurs to me that I'm not going to be sober living this way. Because that's how much faith and trust I have in this. He's completely removed the problem. Like, people will say, like, God now today gave me a choice. And my question to that is, like, what kind of God would give you a choice over something that's going to kill you? Why wouldn't he just take it away so you don't have to make the choice anymore? All right. So when I wake up every day, I have choices to make. What I'm going to wear, when I'm going to shower, how long I'm going to spend in prayer and meditation, which of my books do I want to read this morning? Not once, and I can't remember the last time, I'm not going to drink today. That's the choice I'm making. I never, in a fit spiritual condition, that's not one of the choices. It's been removed. Now, your question is, I'm making a choice to surrender. The way my mind works is, why didn't I make that choice before I lost my home and filed bankruptcy, before I had no place to live, before I torched every relationship in my life, you know, before I was looking at 3 years in prison? Why? All the evidence had been piling on me for years. You know, the thing is, I did choose to surrender. And if you plugged the lie detector test to me, I probably would have passed it. When they took me into that office in HR and they said, Tarek, you have used all your PTO. You have no personal days. You have no sick days. If you don't accrue some PTO and you don't show up to work, we're going to have to fire you. I said, I'm going to show up to work. You have nothing to worry about. I meant it. With all of what I am, I meant it. I got fired 2 weeks later for not being at work. I made a choice. Several times I made this choice to surrender. So for me, in the way I have it, my orientation toward this idea of God, I always want to view the decision not being of me, because I am willing to do so much for this God. I do so much. I want to do so much for this power that has surrendered me. All right, so I say the power surrendered me. My time at the Salvation Army, that homeless shelter, also showed me that, man, because a lot of these guys, they convinced me. But it was a fleeting decision. And slowly, man, and then they could be in there in January and February. As soon as it turns March and that temperature goes up, they gone. What happened to that surrender? Again, this is not me saying you have to believe this way. What I'm trying to do is share my experience with these things. Because me positioning myself that way with God. Remember at the beginning, I told you I got a debt to pay, and I'm the only one that can pay that debt? Because he gave me something. He gave me the commitment and the surrender. That's a gift.
I'll also caution you that, like, although the steps need to be worked in order, and although they all have their own specific thing behind them, they all blend after a time, right? And so that first step kind of becomes the second and third step thing couples with 6 and 7 into 10 and 11 and 12, right? Is there's no, this bothers people when I say this, but if God wants you to get drunk, are you willing to get drunk? Most people would say, well, fuck no. Okay, well then is God everything or not? Because the best use of Brandon may be for Brandon to die in a fiery, horrific thing to demonstrate to other people what it looks like when a person who was spiritually fit is no longer. Now, I have a belief system and with this connection with this power of God that is, as long as I'm useful to the universe, I'm still going to be here. Okay. There have been a multitude of experiences in my life where if God wanted me dead, I'd be dead, period. I had one about a month ago where I'm driving 75 miles an hour down the road, and I pull into the feed store, and when I pull into the parking spot, like my truck stops turning, I get underneath, the tie rods become disconnected. The thing that keeps my wheel headed straight or turning left or right is no longer connected. I'm running in my truck 75 miles an hour down the road. That thing decides to become disconnected. I might not be here tonight. Okay? God wants me here for a reason, because I'm useful. So the choice is, am I useful? So that's more 10 and 11. Right, that's more being connected with this consciousness. So one can't really stand by itself without taking the coupling of it, because the reality is my first step started in the heart of somebody else's 12th step. And they circle back and they fold into themselves. And it's not just, if you're going through the steps mechanically, one check, two check, three check, you ain't staying sober.
And, you know, this might be semantics, what you're saying, though. Like, I invite you to practice the daily surrender, because your own practice of your daily surrender might be an expression of your total surrender, right? Do it day in and day out. What I don't want is for you guys to believe or think that we're telling you there's multiple interpretations to life and existence, right? What you're hearing come out of my mouth is my interpretation of the way I've experienced life. And so it just makes it easier for me that way, because I have a problem when people say they're powerless and they have a choice. The two cannot exist at the same time. To be powerless means there's something overpowering you. And to have a choice means you have power. And so the idea that the two can exist at the same time doesn't work for me.
Well, and just in culture of the context of what I'm saying, I do believe grace is given to me. It's nothing I got on my own. However, I have made a conscious choice to give my life over to God, mm-hmm. to give my right of choice or free will over to His. But, you know, that's a choice in itself.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
And look, we love the question and we love these conversations. Like, You and I, we could sit outside by a fire pit all night long and continue this conversation and blow God up and shrink God and do it. Like these spiritual conversations are the things that you'll get me running forever on.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
well, you know, I was asked this question. How many times have you chosen something and 15 minutes later done the exact opposite? Okay. So this is always going to be what came first, the hen or the egg type conversation, you know? Like, you got one guy up here who believes that there is such a thing as free will. You got me who I don't believe there is such a thing as free will. Two completely different opinions about existence and the life. It influences what's coming out of my mouth right now. He and I never tried to prove the other person wrong. His interpretation is true.
For me.
For him. My interpretation is true for me. But the beautiful thing about different traditions and different ideas about existence, the beauty happens when two people that have different opinions can actually have a conversation without trying to prove the other person wrong. Where it's two individuals having a dialogue about what it's like to be a human being in this crazy thing called the world, and you're just exchanging, you're just comparing notes about it. That's it. So if what you're, there's only one morality that we're going to walk away with this weekend. If what you're doing works, then keep doing it. That's all. If what you're doing doesn't work, then investigate a different alternative. That's what we, you know, we want you to walk away with a desire to do the work that the big book asks you to do so you can have your own version of a transformation. That's what we can guarantee you. If you attempt to live the process outlined in this book, that you will change. I don't know how it's going to change. The change is going to take place. What aspects of your life are going to change? I don't know. But that's what I can guarantee you, is change will take place. You know, it's like Breaking Bad, right? What's chemistry? The study of change, right? This is chemistry here that we're involved with. So, you got anyone?
No.
I don't know why.
It might be blue. I don't know.
I got something I want to read. And this is, again, goes in line with your question. Man is the creature. This is from The Spirituality of Imperfection by Ernest Kurtz, AA historian. He wrote another book called AA, Not God. It's an incredible book here. Man is the creature who wants to be God. Jean Paul Sartre observed, the spirituality of imperfection wrestles directly with that quest, assuring that although, first of all, we have to quit playing God, whoever or whatever God is, he, she, or it does not scorn our quest or despise us for our defects and imperfections, addiction being one of them. Imperfection is rather the crack in the armor, the wound that lets God emerge from the heart. As Meister Eckhart, he's a mystical Christian, wrote almost 700 years ago, to get at the core of God at his greatest, one must first get into the core of himself at his least. In a modern expression of Eckhart's insight, Jungian analyst Marion Woodman identifies addiction as one of the wounds that allows God to emerge. Addiction keeps a person in touch with God. At the very point of the vulnerability is where the surrender takes place. That is where God enters and emerges. God comes through the wound. God comes through the wound, our very imperfections, what religion labels as sins. What therapy calls as being sick, what philosophy terms as errors, are precisely what bring us closer to the reality that no matter how hard we try to deny it, we are not the ones in control here. And this realization inevitably and joyously brings us closer to the idea of God and God itself. One of the disconcerting and delightful teachings of the Master was, God is closer to sinners than he is to saints. This is how he explained it. God in heaven holds each person by a string. When you sin, you cut the string. Then God ties it up again and makes a knot, and thereby bringing you closer to him. Again and again, your sins cut the string. And with each further knot, God keeps drawing you closer and closer. I read things like this, and they land deeply in my heart, and they give me they finally make sense, man. Don't you want a new meaning for the hell that your relationship with alcohol and drugs puts you through? Don't you want to convert the greatest liability you've ever had into the greatest asset that you will ever have? My greatest asset, the best thing that the creator of the universe did for this human being. There's never going to be another model. This is the only model of this human being, but he gave me a gift and he made me a crackhead. Yeah. And why do I say that? Because my experience with crack cocaine has allowed me to help be a conduit to carry the message to other men. And I've got to watch them transform. And that's more addictive than any crack rock I ever hit. Watching someone else change through this process is a miracle that nobody should ever miss. But so many, countless people miss it. And it's a rare occurrence, unfortunately. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics and addicts have what are called vital spiritual experiences. That's what my experience has played out for me over these years. And so as we get further into these steps over the course of the weekend, there's always going to be trap doors where you can get out, departure points where you can get out. You know, the big book says you may be suffering from a spiritual illness, which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And the trap door is the word only. Only, O-N-L-Y. The word only is a trap door because in your mind, you might be saying to yourself, I don't know if that's a true statement. I don't know if that's the only solution for me. And so what I tell you, that's what we call step zero, right? Step zero is that wonderfully horrific time between your last drink and your last drug and when you commit to this way of life. And what ends up happening in step zero is you go around in circles, burning away all the other options. Die the addict death, live life on a spiritual basis, but wait till my parents cut me off. Die the alcoholic death, live life on a spiritual basis, I'm going to go to meetings and stick with the winners. Die the addict death, live life on a spiritual basis, I'm going to try therapy. Okay? We had a guy that we knew. I don't know why I'm telling this story, but I'm going to tell it. So there's a guy that I knew from my past, right before I got sober. And he was a bad junkie, bad heroin addict. And he showed up, and we were at a weekend workshop like this. And we were in an audience that particular weekend. And I somehow found out, I don't know if I knew beforehand, but this guy was working with Brandon. So technically, I was his grand sponsor, and he was my buddy. We had a bunch of mutual friends. And him and Brandon were doing some work. And the reason I'm telling this story is like Brandon made a comment about it earlier, this idea of like, keep coming back, man. I wish to God they wouldn't say that stuff at meetings, right? I'd rather hear them say stay, not keep coming back. Because the implication there is I can go and come as I want. I can go get high tonight, and I'll be back. These people are all going to be waiting for me. They're going to welcome me with open arms, right?
They'll love me until I can love myself.
And so Nick was a bad junkie. Brandon, you know, is the real alcoholic and doesn't have that experience. So they butted heads a little bit, and Nick didn't identify with him. And I try to get into it. I'm on the phone with Nick, and I'm explaining to him, like, you know, you shouldn't do this. So his thing, his step zero, he was still burning alternatives, die the addict death, live life on a spiritual basis, or he was going to go see an addictionologist, right? And then he wanted to go see his priest because he was Catholic. And he said, and I swear to you, on the phone that night, these are the words he said to me. He said, Tarek, I'm going to go try this stuff. And if it doesn't work, you guys say keep coming back. I know where to come back to. And he was dead 2 weeks later. So, and this ain't something, I mean, the action has to be taken now. You know, now is this moment that you guys have in front of you. You have an opportunity to take a course of action. And the unfortunate truth is, man, the majority of you are not going to take the action. And you might be sitting in here going, fuck this redhead dude. You know, who the hell does he think he is coming up in here and telling me what may or may not happen? Or what?
You don't know me.
Well, then, if your anger towards me motivates you, like, I'll show him this shit doesn't work. Go. Show me. And I wish to God I was wrong. But I'm not. I've been doing this long enough to know that it's rare that I find someone who thoroughly follows the path that we're talking about. We don't do it perfectly. We make mistakes, and we've both had dark times in our time here. You know, I've had a failed marriage, and now I'm in a wonderful relationship, but I went through a lot of stuff, and I've had, you know, I got, over the weekend, I'll tell you guys, I rebuilt that relationship with my dad. Then I had to watch my dad die. Right? And then I had to watch the woman that raised me die. And so I've had all these horrific things happen to me while I've been here. It hasn't been happy, joyous, and free. That's another thing they sell us on. If you work these steps, get a sponsor, get a home group, you're going to be in happy, joyous, and free all the time. No, that's not true. That's not the human condition. You're going to experience the exact opposite of those things too. All right? What's important here is, like, how do we get here and stay here? That's what this program is about. It's about hooking you up with a source of power that will solve all of your problems. Like, it's solved, and my own life is evidence. That's why I'm so passionate about it. And I've seen it work in a lot of guys. I've been fortunate that I've sponsored a lot of guys over the years that have stayed active. And they get I see the evidence all the time.
Spirit, help me show them, the men in this room, the same tolerance, pity, and patience that I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. Keep keep me safe, safe and protected, keep them safe and protected. Here's one of the experiences how I know, tying into to Tarek's and Step Zero. Here's how I know that God speaks through me in ways that I'm completely unaware of. I had a sponsee call me. I got him up to the third step three times and got him to the ninth step once. And one of those times he calls me and he's in treatment. He was a bad one. He had to be physically separated from alcohol. He could not stop. So he had to go to detox. And he calls me one time from detox and he said, I finally did my homework. I was like, good. What was your homework? And he said, I wrote out a list of all the ways that I tried to stop or moderate my drinking. I'm thinking to myself, that's a pretty good exercise. I like it. And I was like, oh, yeah, well, what'd you come up with? He says, well, I quit at 40. I was like, oh, so you tried to quit 40 different times. He goes, no. I tried to quit 40 different ways. Most of those I tried multiple times. I said, oh. I was like, so cool. Is that your homework that you had to do for IOP or PHP or whatever, one of the P's? And he's like, no. He said, you told me to do this. And I was like, are you sure? And he goes, yeah. And he describes the event and the experience when I told him to do it. And I remember because it was a very specific moment with where my stepson came into the kitchen and was doing something, and I really dressed him down, and then here's my buddy who's like, you know, 5 days sober, and he goes, man, you were really harsh with him. And I'm thinking to myself, shut up, motherfucker, you're only 5 days sober, right? But it was one of those things where it was like the fact that he was calling me out on something I was doing, I paid attention to it, right? So he described that day when I gave him this homework assignment. And I was like, that's a really good homework assignment. So what I would encourage all of you to do when you're looking at your first step is to write out all the different ways that you tried to stop or moderate. If you don't come up with at least 20, you're cheating the assignment. If you get up to around 50, you can probably quit because the point's been made, is that you've tried treatment, step work, maybe just marijuana, maybe a girl, maybe a new job, maybe a change of scenery. You've done all these things, right? And guess what? If you're sitting in this room, none of it worked. So whenever there's a third option, accept spiritual help, go on to the bitter end, or just smoke marijuana, or just get a new job, or just go back to the Bridges of Hope. Whenever there's a third option, it's not spiritual help, bitter end, you're probably not done. Because you're going to pick the third option every time. Because it's easier. So, in the doctor's opinion, they talk about this thing called frothy emotional appeal and how it seldom suffices. You know what frothy emotional appeal is? It's when anybody tells you to do it for some reason, right? You should want to get sober for your kids. You should not want to drink and drive because you'll go to jail. Okay? You might die. Any of those things, that's just frothy emotional appeal, right? That is simply somebody trying to convince you that it's a good idea to be sober, right? Until we have completely exhausted all those things, we're probably not really going to be in a place where we're ready. It talks about it in We Agnostics. If a mere code of morals or better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism and addiction, many of us would have recovered long ago, right? If I can still do something to stay sober, that implies that I have power. Okay? So when we're in this place, right, we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable, right? The unmanageability, it's not because of drugs and alcohol. It's because I have no capacity to exist without an altered state. Right? in a vision for you. It says, now and then, serious drinker or drug user, being dry or clean at the moment, says, I don't miss it at all. Feel better, work better, having a better time. As ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such a sally. We know our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He fools himself. Inwardly, he would give anything to take a half dozen drinks, shots, or anything to get away and get away with them. He will presently try the old game again, for he isn't happy about his sobriety. He cannot picture life without alcohol or drugs. Someday he will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness such as few do. He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. Right? That, the wishing for the end, the realizing that there's nothing you can do. Right? I hear sometimes people, they say that, well, I've worked the first step because I showed up at a meeting. Then why the fuck does the book take so many pages to explain the first step? Because maybe there's more to the first step than just showing up at a meeting. I also hear people say that there's hope in the first step. Okay? If there's still hope in the first step for you, you hadn't done it enough times. Because here's the reality. What the first step abundantly confirms for me is I'm fucked. There is nothing I have ever been able to do. There is nothing I can do to stay sober, to stay clean. Everything I've tried, always failure. What the first step tells Brandon is that 100% of the time, Brandon's drunk. 100% of the time. It may take 4 days, but Brandon's drunk again. Because what the rest of the world doesn't understand is that drugs and alcohol are my solution. The problem is I can't live. I can't exist. There is nothing I can do to make me okay with being me. Nothing. I've had the money. I've had the car. I've had the girl. I've had the girls on the side. I've had the world championship dog. I've had like all that stuff. None of it mattered, right? The reality is that it wasn't until the thing that Tarek talks about, that place of unacceptance. Brandon no longer is okay with Brandon. And then what happens is the space opens, this tiny, tiny, tiny little space opens. I call it God's grace. You can call it whatever you want. A small window opens to where we have access to a new experience. But that window slammed shut. It will close. It's like you're on the down escalator trying to go up. If you don't keep moving, you end up in a heap at the bottom of it. You have to move. You get this opportunity to move through that space, to have this experience, to connect with whatever this thing is. God's going to change for you as you go. It's going to morph and it's going to move and it's going to do some things. And you're going to have conversations and it's going to shift and it's going to change. And then you're going to realize that, wait, so God can actually help me with every area of my life? Took away the one thing, my alcoholism, the one thing that had me not wanting to exist. Complete failure at living, complete failure at dying, and this power showed up in my life and removed that. So this thing, whatever it is, the creator of the universe and everything in it, like, can take away my alcoholism, but it can't help me with my finances? Can't help me with my relationships? Can't help me with my career? You see, because when you're here for a while, and Tarek and I'll do these workshops from time to time, and it's not just people that are experiencing sobriety, early sobriety. Like we have these workshops where people have have been sober for 10, 15, 20 years, and they're not satisfied with their life, right? And they have to explore the first step in a new area. They have to explore, what is it like being powerless in everything I do? Because when you leave here, conceivably the drugs and alcohol will be completely out of your system if you've actually done this thing properly, right? So the drugs and the alcohol are no longer your problem. Your problem is how to exist without them. And that's the real part of the first step, that is my life unmanageable, period. Has everything I've ever done to manage my life ended up in failure? Yeah. Even at 10, 11 years sober, these things continue to show up in my life to prove to me, oh yeah, you think you're doing pretty good? Pay attention over here. You neglected this area. You think that you can handle this stuff, maybe you should trust God in this area. And here's the cool thing is the experience, the way that it works, in my opinion, is that you continue to get the same experience over and over again until you learn how to trust God with it. There is no hope for me in this first step. I'm fucked. You're fucked. We're all fucked. So, I mean, maybe there's a different way. Maybe we should explore something different. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there's a different way? Have I been thoroughly convinced that my way doesn't work? Because that's what the first step's about. If your way's working, keep doing it. If it's not, maybe show up tomorrow.
I'm gonna leave you guys with a quick story. There's a guy out in the, he was hunting. And he was out by this lake, and he was hunting some geese. He shoots this geese and goose, and the thing falls into the water. And then coming roaring out of the woods comes this dog. And this dog walks across the water, retrieves that goose, and brings it to the guy who shot it down. And this guy's mind is just blown. He's like, I can't believe what I just witnessed with my own eyes. This dog walked across the water. All right, and so he hangs out with this dog all day. And at one point, the dog decides it's just going to go off. And he comes back the next day. And the dog comes out and walks across the water and retrieves all the geese this guy's shooting down all day. So he goes home that day, and he's got this alcoholic guy that lives next door. He thinks he's a drunk. And he walks over to his neighbor, and he says, hey, man, how about you go hunting with me tomorrow? Come on, man. I got something incredible that I want to show you. Let's go hunting tomorrow. And, you know, the drunk, you know, he's reluctant. He just wants to sit in his house and drink all day and, you know, smoke some joints. And finally convinces this guy to go out with him the next day. And so he's out there and they're hunting and they're shooting the geese down, and the dog's nowhere to be found. And so after a while, he sees the drunk's about to leave, and he shoots this bird, and the bird falls in the water. And here comes the dog, just super graceful, running, and just walks and runs across the water and retrieves this bird and brings it back to the guy who shot it down. And the guy's looking at the drunk, and the drunk's just like looking up in the sky, and he's like, hey, man, you notice anything funny about that dog? And the drunk says, the poor thing can't swim. Which mind do you want to bring to this? The one that says, wow, there's so much available here. There's possibility here, man. It's not just about not drinking and not using and just going to meetings. Way more than that. We thank you so much for being an engaged audience. And we'll see you back here in the morning. Have a good night.